in the series of talks that we started some 2 years ago, covering the synthesis of yoga by Sri Aurobindo, we covered the yoga of works and the yoga of knowledge at peace in Auroville, and thereafter we took up the way of love, bhakti yoga. Here there was an interruption thereafter because we felt that it was necessary to have a grounding in the teachings of the mother before one could read with full benefit the last section of the synthesis of yoga, the yoga of self-perfection. As you are all aware, Sri Aurobindo has enumerated the main principles of karma yoga, jnana yoga and bhakti yoga in his series in the light of modern thought, and presently he proceeds to develop his own yoga of self-perfection. Not indeed discarding the results of the lines of yoga which we have studied so far, but assimilating them and utilizing their results for larger ends. He has sought to pull out yoga from the hermitages and specialized cottages into the open, so that yoga could be a way of life itself. Yoga could be utilized to develop life to its optimum. And that is why he has called his integral yoga as the yoga of self-perfection. In all lines of yoga that we have studied, they take up any one power, one faculty that is developed, that is prominent in the system, and utilize that as the springboard to delve into yoga. It may be one power or a group of powers, but only that power is utilized, developed, so that a leap into the infinite is made possible from that jumping ground. For instance, in Hatha Yoga, which in some form or other is today highly popular in the West and also in parts of the East, this is upon the body and the life energy. They attach great importance to the physical body, and they have evolved certain exercises, postures of limbs, which are called asanas, by which all physical energies are collected together, are withdrawn from their dissipating movements, held together for a while, trained to be collected, and the body is gradually accustomed to longer and longer periods of immobility, so that it could function as a foundation for the yogic edifice. When the body is trained to hold itself for considerable periods in immobile status, all the energies that are gathered, they start raising themselves in their potency. They acquire more effectivity, more power. After that is done, the Hatha Yogins concentrate upon the life force, the breathing, and with the aid of pranayam, which we have studied somewhat, the regulation and the elongation of breath, they acquire control over life force, over breathing, over the nervous energies. And both the energies, the physical energies and the life energies, so gathered, so controlled, so regulated, they are thereafter directed to pour into that center of the physical body where is involved the life power or the life energy or nature energy, containing in itself diverse forms of energy. This spot where this nature energy is concentrated is at the base of the spine, and that energy is called in this literature Kundalini. When the physical energies and the life energies are poured and directed to smite on this center, the Kundalini is awakened. It rises up, shoots up through various centers of energies in the body, opens new channels for a function activity to those energies, and goes on traversing upward till it goes to the brain and above, and meets what is known as Shiva or the silent static consciousness. The rationale is, when nature energy succeeds in contacting the divine status above, there is a liberation of consciousness. Man is no more held as a slave to the lower nature, and he breathes the freedom of the higher regions. This is Hatha Yoga. Raja Yoga also, for instance, it concentrates upon the mind, the mental energies, with a few preliminary exercises of purification, and meditation and self-disciplining, for that's ultimately the meaning of Yama and Niyama, spoken of by Patanjali. They proceed with the aid of asanas and pranayama to acquire sufficient control over the bodily and the life functions, sufficient enough to exercise control over the mental activity. They have found out that by acquiring mastery over the movements of breathing life force, they can bring the mind to a silent status, control the thought activity, and with further steps of discipline like meditation, concentration, they aim at releasing the mental energies into the quietude of samadhi or trance, detach the mental apparatus entirely from outer nature, still it, quiet it, so that in its silence, in its immobility, the inner self, the Atman, reflects itself as in a lake, limpid lake. That is the aim of Raja Yoga, liberation through the mind. Thus in each of the lines of yoga, one path is taken up. The Hatha Yoga we can call the psychophysical system, the Raja Yoga may be called the psychological system, and psychological and spiritual and psychological system. And then we have the famous triple path, the path of knowledge, the path of works, the path of devotion, normally associated together. And in each of these, the aim is to fix upon the faculties of knowledge, for instance, purify them, gain control over them by discrimination, by rejection, by acceptance of what is right, and turn them into a spiritual movement, so that the thought mind, as we know, the discursive mind with which we are familiar, that is trained to grow into a spiritual consciousness, a spiritual outlook, a spiritual reference, and gradually converts itself into a spiritual mind. Spiritual mind has a spiritual vision, a spiritual center of thinking. And as it grows, the mind gets liberated into a spiritual dimension. Similarly, with the yoga, with karma yoga, the yoga of works, the dynamic will is seized and it is trained to consecrate itself, to offer itself to the Supreme Lord, the Master of Works. And in this very process of surrender and disinterested exertion, the will gets transformed and is elevated into a status where it can unite with the will of the Lord. So also with the yoga of love or the yoga of devotion, it is the heart's emotions the capacity in the heart for identification with others, for loving. These capacities are taken hold of and directed to flow upwards rather than outwards. The heart centers are systematically tapped, and the very texture of the emotional being is subjected to a spiritual culture, with the result that the whole of the emotional being around the soul ultimately melts into a love and adoration of the Divine. There, in that area, the liberation is effected. But it is also a fact that though one may start at any point, start with any power that is prominent, that can be conveniently seized upon, as Sri Aurobindo says, all power is one. Ultimately, whatever the power you cultivate, whatever the power you exploit, ultimately, each power reveals itself to be one with other powers. For instance, the power of knowledge, as it develops, it also reveals itself to be the spring behind the impulse for dedication and disinterested works. It also reveals itself that it is the spring for love of God. Unless one knows that the Divine is the Supreme, the Divine is my Master, the Divine is the Lord, true love cannot spring up, true love cannot form. So also, if you start with love, as love develops, the knowledge dawns that the one whom I worship, the one whom I adore, is the Lord of all, not my alone. So thus, each power, as it develops, enters into the territory, man-made territories, mind-made territories of other powers. And that is because all power is power of the soul. Every power in life derives from the soul. This gives rise to the possibility of having a yoga which is not concerned with one power alone, with the liberation of one part alone, but a kind of synthetic yoga which combines or can combine all methods and make the liberation as extensive, as wide and as high as possible. And it is not that attempts have not been there so long in Indian history. There is, for instance, the tantric yoga, the yoga of the tantras. They have seized upon this truth that all life moves between two ends, soul and nature, soul and shakti, purusha and shakti. And they have attempted to embrace life from one end to the other end. They have not sought to take only one power, but they have sought to include all the powers by extending their vision from one end to the other. They, in their practice, they also seize upon the different motive forces that makes nature exert itself and seek to give them full value, like desires, emotions, activities, raise them to a certain higher level, give them diviner values and allow them a part, their due roles in the working of yoga. Not only do the tantrics attempt to take up the whole of nature without making distinction of high and low and turn it Godward, but it is also part of their aim to seek to derive the utmost value from life, not merely liberation, but what we may call a full exploitation of the resources of life, not mukti alone, but also bhukti, a cosmic enjoyment. Is a legitimate claim of a divinized nature. This has been there for centuries. Whatever the deformations that may have taken place in its practice, the Tantra Yoga, in its conception, is a grand attempt at synthesis. The synthesis of the present age on which Sri Aurobindo has worked is still larger. It combines, as one would expect, the best of all the yogas, not in a kind of artificial unity, but in a living synthesis. As he puts it so graphically, this yoga, the yoga of self-perfection, the integral yoga, because it is so called Purna Yoga, because its vision is wide, it covers the whole of life. The liberation that it envisages is a liberation for all the parts of man. Now this yoga starts, this synthesis starts with the method of the Vedanta in order to reach the aim of the Tantra. Let me explain. In the Tantras, they take hold of the Shakti, nature power, and try to arrive at the Divine Soul through a manipulation and utilization of the Shakti. In the Vedanta, they start with the soul, they start with the self, not with the Shakti, not with nature. But in Vedanta what they do, they start with the self, and once they arrive at the self, they depart in the self. But here, once you start with the self, the Purusha, inner Purusha, make that as the center of the movement, you arrive at a higher consciousness, which equips you without danger to practice the aim of the Tantra, which is to take up all nature and raise it to a diviner level. If one were to start with nature in the beginning itself, it is a risky process, because very often people get bogged down into the processes, perhaps the glittering processes of nature, and they miss the aim altogether. If one establishes oneself in soul consciousness before, arrives at a certain freedom, liberation in the soul center, gets sufficiently detached to begin with, acquires certain mastery over nature, from that poise it is possible to extend the rule of the soul, the rule of the inner being, more and more in life, bring the external and the lower nature under control, subject it to the process of purification and elevation, and ultimately hope to arrive at a state of liberation, which includes not only the liberation of the soul, but the liberation of nature also from ignorance and falsehood. When Prakriti is released from falsehood, from Maya, it becomes Shakti. And Shakti is nothing else except Shiva himself. It is the Lord as nature. It is revealed not as something different from the Lord, but a poise of the Lord. Another difference between the tantric synthesis and the synthesis of which Sri Aurobindo speaks is that one starts in this Tantras from below. All attempt is first directed towards the awakening of the lower center. In the process, all the lower energies are set into movement. One first comes into contact with the restless nature, which is ignited into activity. And one has to follow the laborious process of coming up step by step on one's own oars. But in this synthesis, one starts with the soul in the mind, with the spirit as embodied in the mind. One starts here. One opens these levels to the higher Shakti, to the higher consciousness. And once it is received and entered, it is that yoga shakti that moves step by step, opening up various areas and regions of consciousness and being, and working its way. One starts at a safe level. Instead of starting from the bottom, one starts at the top, where one is more conscious, where things are more under control. And man himself being a mental being, it is very natural for him to start in the mind. One knows better, one is aware better, one can control better. So it is from the top that this synthesis starts. The process is a self-surrender, and a self-surrender at all points. Not the self-surrender of a bhakta who surrenders only here in the heart, nor of a jnanin who exposes only his mental summits, But at all points at which one is conscious, one directs that will to surrender. One knows and recognizes that this vast endeavor cannot be done by one's own effort. One opens oneself to the higher Shakti, to the divine power, and makes an effort to consistently keep open every part of oneself of which one is conscious to the action of the descending force, allows the divine to possess oneself. One does not seek to go up and possess the Lord. One throws oneself open, keeps oneself exposed to be possessed by the divine. In this, these are two features, and the third feature is enlargement of the objects of yoga. Whether in the traditional lines of yoga or in the yoga of the tantras of which we have been speaking, the whole effort is directed towards the liberation of the individual. But here, it is recognized that an individual liberation, individual action, individual result is a partial result. Man does not live alone. Whether he likes it or not, he is part of the cosmos. The divine that is in him is also there in others. And his own liberation, his own perfection can never be complete, can never be whole, unless that liberation and that perfection is worked out at least to a certain extent in those around him. So this dimension, universal aspect, the aspect of a cosmic realization, cosmic effort, the cosmic problem, is a speciality of this synthesis. It is recognized that man is part of the universe, and if he is to be whole, the universe also has to participate. He has also to contribute to the total evolution of the universe. And here comes in the conception and the practice of collective yoga. The aim being the perfection of life, at a divinization of life, and no life can be perfected or divinized in its solitary greatness. Because one has to have impacts, one has to receive currents from outside, from above, from below, from around. And unless those levels around oneself are also raised, are also subjected to a certain purification, and an environment is created by which there is a growing perfection in a collectivity, however small it may be, no individual perfection or liberation is safe. So this is another aspect of the synthesis. Freedom from ego, freedom from ignorance, possession of one's nature by the divine consciousness, This has to go step by step in the individual, enlarge itself to cover larger and larger areas. In the course of its own self-affirmation, no realization is worth this salt, worth its name, unless it can stand the scrutiny of tests, unless it can meet life face to face and prove itself equal to it, to the demands made by it. And this is where a gradual evolution of a Gnostic self, a collectivity of seekers of yoga who build a milieu, who build a realm where this common ideal of liberation and perfection in the Divine, possession by the Divine, these are practiced, each one helping the other, the collectivity helping the individual and the individual contributing to the collectivity. This is a dimension which again is new. One may start, indeed, it is not easy to start at all points. One starts in this yoga also, as in other yogas, at a point where one is strong. My strong point may be the heart. I may have a larger capacity to extend myself, to love others, to unite with the feelings of others. I start with the way of love. Another may be an intellectual. He starts the mind. Another may be a dynamic worker who doesn't get satisfaction in the contemplative way of life. He starts where he feels he is fitted. But the difference is that we recognize that all these paths, all these powers, they converge after a certain point. These lines meet. Each strengthens the other, each nourishes the other, and there are so many tributaries that join. And carry the soul on its flood. This possibility, or rather this certainty, that all these powers are going to unite at some point, is always kept in mind. Things do not happen exactly logically, step by step. One may start with the mind. Suddenly there may be an opening in the heart, but it is not asked to wait till the mind is developed. It is taken up on the way. It is joined to the mental effort, and there comes in the element of integrality. The whole system, with its entire reservoir of powers, is treated as one unit. The starting points may vary, but after a time, the energies of nature join at different points and become one. These, in short, are the main features which distinguish the new synthesis, the yoga of self-perfection. Any questions?
I'm not going to be tired.
No?
When you spoke about the mind, using the mind in preparation of mental being. There were about three or four places in that chapter where you mentioned that the mind had a certain phrase, and you needed to be sure of soul in the mind, power of the soul in the mind. In some ways, even it sounded like he was suggesting that you do that in the triple path, in all three, but I didn't think that was true.
No, what he means is the spirit in mind, or soul in the mind, we start. We recognize that the divine embodies itself in the mind also, the mental purusha. And we start there, not at the level of reasoning mind or at the level of thought mind. We shall not get bogged down into the processes of analysis. This is right, that is wrong, this is eternal, that is temporal. We will become expert logicians, but not yogins. But if from the beginning you lay stress upon the soul element in the mind, the place where the mind is hooked to the divine, where it naturally opens to the higher levels, where it does not insist on mentalizing thing, experiences. That is the right way to start at the mental level. That is what he means when he says, a spirit embodied in mind. We start there. It's not easy. All of us have to pass through the levels where we are, from the levels to that. But the aim is to arrive at a level or a layer in the mind which is comparatively free from these involvements, and use that as the springboard for developing the consciousness, for opening the being to receive the higher influx.
Is that also used to the other two parts of the Sikhata,
It is the mental consciousness. It is the mental awareness with which we approach the heart or the life energy. We are essentially mental beings. So it is through the mind that we are aware. What is the motive force of my working? How far is my emotions and things are pure? The approach is mental, but not mental in the usual sense. The approach is of the, you can say, awakened mental or enlightened mental. So whether you start in works or in love or in knowledge, the approach is from a layer of the mind which is comparatively purer, nearer the soul, than the ratiocinative mind.
How to control thought?
The one effective way is to intensify our interest in what we want. Supposing we want to realize the divine, the interest must be so created, so developed, that the mind naturally flows into that direction. What normally happens is only a part of ourselves is attracted to the ideal. And when we sit for meditation or contemplation, that part is indeed looking towards what it wants. But the rest of the mind has its own interest, has its own attractions, has its own habits. They all engulf this and we feel restless, we feel the invasion of thoughts. But if that interest in it is widened, established as the strongest point, then thought cannot disturb. To take an example, if there is a good story you are reading, something has come in newspapers which is of absorbing interest, we take it. At that time there may be a musical party going on, a radio may be going on blaring here, some children may be playing. All factors which normally would distract the mind are present. Still, the mind goes on reading because we are interested. When you read a newspaper, you are not disturbed by anything, particularly if there are interesting things. On the same analogy, it has been said, create an interest, intensify that interest, make that interest a capital interest. Then other distractions die down, they become weak. That means, in a word, aspiration, sincerity. Second, thoughts are always there. It is not that when they come more when we sit for meditation or contemplation. We are normally extrovert and our thinking of something or other, some interest or other holds us. But 100 thoughts are simultaneously going on, we are not aware of them. When we close our eyes and sit, we suddenly become aware, hundreds of thoughts are there. The thoughts have not specially come because we are meditating. They are always there, we become aware of it. And meditation or concentration is an occasion to study what are these thoughts that are coming. What do they reveal? They come because something in me wants to think of them. They reveal our nature. Vivekananda used to say, you can utilize those thoughts to study your nature, to find out your weak points and strong points and take appropriate action. And once you start doing that, they dwindle. So Vivekananda spoke of 3 or 4 methods. One is, he said, observe each thought as it comes. Study it. See what it reveals. The thoughts will get tired. They will dwindle. Second, he says, treat them as birds of passage passing through the sky. Just ignore them. Concentrate on what you want. Third, it's a most laborious process. As the thoughts come, reject them. Very difficult. But still it can be done. There are people who are so tense and concentrated that each time a thought comes, they throw it out. Fourth, which Sri Aurobindo recommended and which we have found the most practical, is to cultivate a bifurcation of mind. That is, my central thought, central concentration must be on what I want. The rest, if the thoughts move about, you just ignore them. They run about like flies on the surface. But I am concentrated upon what I want. I think of mother, I think of love for mother, I think of doing work for mother, whatever it is. I am concentrated there. But somewhere I am conscious that things are going on. You ignore them. Gradually what happens, there are 2 layers of the mind. One surface layer, busy with the thoughts, the rest of the mind turned inwards towards the object of meditation. Bifurcation of mind, bifurcation of nature also. This is the easiest way and the most practical way in this yoga. We meet next Sunday.